This is a podcast by The Straits Times and Money FM 89.3.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Speaking of Asia podcast by The Straits Times. This is Ravi Velur, and I'm an associate editor and Asia columnist for the paper. This series of podcasts focuses on Asian issues and distills experience from 4 decades of covering the Asian continent. In this first episode for the year 2022, I speak to one of the foremost climate scientists of the world, Professor Veerabhadran Ramanathan of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California in San Diego. Prof. Ram, as he's widely called, was awarded the Blue Planet Prize last year. He also happens to be a member of the Vatican's Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which makes him the Pope's climate scientist. It is entirely appropriate that Professor Ramanathan should feature in the first Speaking of Asia podcast in 2022. The World Economic Forum lists climate issues as the top global risk for the year, ahead of growing social divides, heightened cyber risks, and an uneven economic recovery. My conversation with Professor Ramanathan also takes place in the wake of the COP26 meeting in Glasgow, which took place at the end of 2021. Professor, welcome to the Speaking of Asia podcast and a Happy New Year.
Prof, I've heard you say that there was a time when only your wife would come to your talks on climate, but today I noticed that you fill the halls. What has happened in these intervening years?
Yeah, that's a remarkable transition. I started working in this area around 1973 when I finished my PhD and joined NASA. I remember my first meeting talking about global warming and greenhouse effect. This is a meeting of the American Meteorological Society. Those days, very few, including scientists, had heard of or even interested in climate change. So my biggest problem when I give my talks is to have few people in the audience. It's invariably me and the other speakers. So I used to tell my wife, you need to come and join me there. I need an audience. So now, in about 45 years, it's just amazing for me, and personally one of gratitude, that climate change has become the number one topic, whether in scientific meetings or in political meetings.
Prof, as we all know, you're one of the pioneers in this field, and you went to the Paris climate talks as well, I remember. I wanted to ask you about the recent COP26 in Glasgow. It looks as though you gave it a miss. Was there a reason for you not going to Glasgow? And what are your assessments of the outcomes from Glasgow?
First, addressing the outcome from the Glasgow meeting, I was probably one of the few who were very happy with that outcome. And I'll tell you why. That about roughly 15 years ago, I realized the world was missing a great opportunity, particularly the scientific world, in reducing the warming quickly. The main focus then was on carbon dioxide, you know, which is the major villain and the major greenhouse gas. Fossil fuels are the primary source of carbon dioxide emission. And it traps heat very efficiently. But my own work has been to point out there are other gases we are dumping into the atmosphere that that trap heat enormously more efficiently than carbon dioxide. Just take chlorofluorocarbons, which is used as a refrigerant and propellant. And I discovered in 1975 that was about more than 10,000 times more potent than CO2. After that study, until then, scientists thought the only gas we need to worry about was carbon dioxide. After that, many other gases were added to the non-CO2 list. In 2008, I started writing a series of papers showing how to bend that warming curve quickly. See, the global warming was going rapidly, steeply. What I said was, we need to do something to bend that curve, flatten it, and then bend it downwards. So to bend that curve quickly, CO2 alone is not going to do it, cutting the emissions by CO2. CO2 has a long-term effect on bending that curve. So what I identified were four super pollutants. They were called short-lived climate pollutants. The first was methane. The second is HFCs. Third is ozone in the lower atmosphere. And the fourth is not a gas, it's a particle, black carbon, soot. What I showed, you know, in a series of papers between 2008 to 2010 was that targeting these four pollutants would cut the rate of warming by half. But some of them were also air pollutants. So I concluded it's going to save at least 2 to 3 million lives lost to air pollution every year. But that took quite some time for policymakers to digest it. So at the Glasgow meeting, on the third day of that meeting, President Biden was able to persuade 100 other nations to come up with the methane pledge. And overnight, I'd estimated that pledge by itself will cut the warming of about 2/10 of a degree, which is 10 years worth of warming. And why was I excited by that? Leading up to Glasgow, in 2016, I was part of that group who persuaded, and they modified the Montreal Protocol, you know, which was done to eliminate, phase out CFCs. The Montreal Protocol was amended by the Kigali Protocol to cut down HFCs. See, HFCs is hydrofluorocarbons. They replaced CFCs as refrigerants and propellants. But we pointed out they're about 2,000 times more potent than CO2. So out of the four global warming, the short-lived climate pollutants, President Biden took care of the methane. The 2016 Kigali Protocol agreed to phase out HFCs. So that left ozone and soot. You see, when you cut methane, ozone also comes down and its warming comes down. So all that was left was the soot. And I had identified a major source of soot emissions, black carbon emissions, is cooking with solid fuels. You know, the poorest 3 billion cannot afford fossil fuels, and they use these primitive cook stoves. And it kills about 3 million every year, mainly women and children. So the United Nations, in 2011, I was part of that. I chaired this group and then co-chaired that group. They created what's called Climate and Clean Air Coalition. That coalition targeted all short-lived climate pollutants, particularly soot and black carbon. So now, if the methane pledge is implemented, and nations like India, Bangladesh, China, and Africa succeed in providing clean cooking solutions to the poorest population. They number 3 billion. We now have the chance to bend that warming curve by half between now to 2040. So to me, although Glasgow did not accomplish much in terms of CO2 mitigation, it was still, I see the glass half full part of Glasgow. I didn't go to Glasgow because I had gone to the COP meetings ever since from the beginning. And I decided now there's no place for scientists to start anything there. It's all for the policymakers. So given the COVID and my own desire to cut my carbon footprint to close to zero, I didn't go to Glasgow.
That's such an interesting response, Prof. Ramnathan. But you know, just to stay on the subject of fossil fuels, do you think the world is doing enough to curb fossil fuels? And I noticed that the language on coal, for instance, at Glasgow was watered down a bit. Instead of phasing, I think the words they used were phasing down rather than phasing out. What do you say, sir?
Yeah. So your question was, is the world doing enough to cut fossil fuels? Not by a long shot. And I'll first tell you how serious the problem is. You know, in 2018, 3 years ago, I teamed up with a few other scientists and concluded the planet is going to cross the 1.5 degree warming by 2030. So why was that such a big deal? The United Nations concluded we are not going to cross the 1.5 degree till 2045. And that's why all the climate policy documents keep saying we need to keep the warming below 1.5. No. We are not going to be able to stop the 1.5 degree warming period because it's going to happen in 8 years. I worry quite a bit about that. We're going to take another few years to recover from COVID, and then we have to get ready for this next major disaster after a pandemic. And my worry is it's going to be a lot worse than that. So I have gone on record saying that the 1.5 degree warming will bring climate change into all of our living rooms. Just like COVID has tied me to my living room last 2 years. It's no more going to be, when that 1.5 degree warming starts, looming on the horizon, it's not going to be any more someone in Bangladesh getting flooded, someone in major fires in Australia, major fires in California. Everyone would feel, and many will suffer from it. So the question is, compare that looming disaster and look at what we are planning, bringing down fossil fuel emissions to zero by 2050, bringing it by half by 2030. Let's take the scenario of that. Let's say the world succeeds in bringing down the emissions to zero by 2030. What does that mean? You see, we are putting about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. If we bring it by half by 2030, okay, we will still be putting about 250 to 300 billion tons. That's a huge amount. Just imagine the sheer weight of it. That's going to surround the planet like a blanket. That blanket of greenhouse gases is already 1 trillion tons thick. And we'll be adding another 25%. We should be bringing down that thick blanket. Instead, we are still adding. So nothing we do is going to stop the 1.5 degree warming. and my our only hope is to keep it below 2 degrees. Along with bringing down the fossil fuel emissions to zero by 2050, we also bring the short-lived climate pollutants. And then on top of that, we have to suck that CO2, which is already there. You know, that blanket of CO2 has to be made thinner. We don't even have scalable technology to do that. So there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. And I see Asian nations, East Asia, South Asia, and Southeast Asia, total population of more than 50% of the planet live in these regions. They're going to suffer immensely from this degree and a half warming, increased flooding, droughts, fires, and sea level rise, all of that. So what I'm now pushing for, I'm changing my whole effort in climate solutions from mitigation to how do we build resilience and adaptation to the population.
Thank you, Professor. I have heard you say that global warming has morphed into a global disruption of the weather systems.
Right.
And we see a lot of studies coming out on this, from World Economic Forum to McKinsey. Many people are focusing on this lately. In your view, Professor, which regions are the most vulnerable?
I wish I can point to some regions. The entire planet is vulnerable. Some are more so than others, not because the severity of extreme weather and sea level rise is going to be less in some regions and more in others. It is simply because population in some regions are more vulnerable and less capable of adapting to it. Okay, so if I look at it that way, you can almost look at the GDP of each nation, per capita GDP, which is below average, are all going to suffer. You know, entire South Asia, most parts of Southeast Asia, even China, parts of China. And moving on, Australia is going to have some nightmarish scenarios of fires and droughts in the western part. Moving on, I mean, South America, Latin America, we see massive migration. So it is a worldwide catastrophe. And I think the only way we are going to cope with this problem is not by pointing fingers at each other. Somehow the world has to come together. The UN, you know, the UNFCCC, IPCC, and the COP, they're all steps in the right direction. But I don't see any one of them planning for the resilience. You know, it's almost treated as a stepchild. Building adaptation and resilience has to take the same importance as mitigation.
Thank you, Prof. If the drier regions are getting drier and the wetter ones are getting wetter, what happens to those of us who live along the equator?
That's a very interesting question. Scientifically, it's a fascinating question, but none of this is any more scientifically fascinating for me. It's more one of human tragedy. So the equatorial regions, like where you are, you know, you have the so-called intertropical convergence zone, moisture coming from both north and south, okay? And that moves with the seasons. And it's likely that could get erratic. So you ask, why is that? Because that whole movement of this intertropical convergence zone, which brings massive rains in parts where you are, that's also driven by, you know, temperature gradient difference between the equator and the polar region. And the polar region is heating in a great hurry because the sea ice is melting. And we just finished a study in which it's just being, you know, reviewed. We are showing in parts of equatorial region, the driving force of the monsoon circulation is increased and increasing enormously. So I expect already, as you know, in the regions you live, when it rains, it pours. So your rain intensity will increase. It's already increasing. You know, when the monsoon comes, there's nothing but flooding. So that's going to be a big problem, intense rainfall, juxtaposed with droughts. And, you know, parts of Indonesia has huge fires. And if it's any consolation to you, of all the nations I see, Singapore probably is better equipped just because of your sheer economy and how your buildings are built. It's going to be more resilient, a little more resilient than other nations in Southeast Asia.
That's a small comfort, Professor Ram.
Exactly.
But if climate change can affect everybody as COVID has done, and to the credit of the world, the COVID vaccines came out in pretty decent time compared with previous pandemics. Now, are there available remedies for climate change, or is it too late in the day?
No, first of all, there are remedies and nothing is too late. And it is late, not too late, late if you are poor, because they're just going to lose their homes, lose their, you know, lives. And so what can we do? I think our first target has to be to prevent it from getting much worse. Okay? So when I say much worse, if we don't do anything about it, we say, oh, it's just too late, let's not do anything. The warming interval, 1.5, can become 3-4 degrees. That definitely would pose existential threat for everyone, except the most wealthiest. So what we need to do is definitely work hard to cut down the emissions. The Glasgow is a good step forward, but I think the developed nations, America, Europe, and you know, China now, and others have to take a lead. Take the moral and technological leadership to bring down the emissions and share that technology worldwide. But in parallel, each nation has to do, whether they are poor or rich, has to have to do their own, on their own, start planning to protect people from mass displacement, mass migration, health effects. I put the mental health effects on top of this list. So we don't have an option to give up on it because our lives would be threatened. Entire planet's survival would be threatened. So that's not an option, what you're talking about. So we have to take steps, but as we delay, we lose more and more of our options. You see, until about 5 years ago, we had the option of not thinking about adaptation and resilience. We could think just about mitigation, not anymore. So it's going to get more and more expensive. And honestly, I haven't seen any leader in COP or anyways really feeling the urgency and the immensity of the problem.
That's sad to hear.
This podcast is available on our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Like us and rate us. And now, back to our podcast episode.
Professor Ram, are there practical and proven ways to cut down on global warming? And can you name three steps you think we could do fairly quickly?
Yeah. I was waiting for this question for the last half an hour. This is the question I'd like to ask. Three steps, exactly. I call them three levers strategy, okay? First, every nation has to pull as hard as on the short-lived climate pollutants, bringing down methane emissions, okay? And I want to tell you how simple and easy that is. We throw about 30% to 40% of the food in the garbage. That food, when you throw it into the landfills, converts to methane, which is about 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide, okay? So all the steps to cut the short-lived pollutants and bring that lever down, we have already the technologies. We know how to cut soot from diesel vehicles. We know we have replacement for HFCs. So there's just no excuse not to do that. That will slow down the warming quickly. That's a lever number one. The second lever, they're all of equal importance. So there's not the first, second, and third. There are three levers. The second one is to phase out fossil fuels. I just published a study 2 days ago in a major journal, Nature. And we have to bring the fossil fuel down, not in 30 years, but about 15 to 20 years. Bring it down to zero. And you ask, how do you do that? Solar, wind, and hydro will already take us about 65% of that way. We can cut down 65% of the emissions, solar and wind. We have the technology. Everywhere, particularly in Southeast Asia and tropical countries, solar and wind are cheaper than fossil fuels, okay? So what do we do for the remaining 35%? We bring in hydrogen, right? Produce hydrogen from breaking water by solar sunlight. Again, it's called electrolysis. And use the hydrogen. Already, the Honda, and Hyundai, they make hydrogen fuel cars. All these technologies are here. So at the end, how do you bring down the emissions? One simple sentence: electrify all the end use. Your home heating, your air conditioning, everything has to be electric. Your cooking, and generate that electricity with solar, wind, what's called modular nuclear. And where needed, biofuels. Okay, convert manure into a renewable fuel. So all those are there. They're just off the shelf. The question then you ask, if it's off the shelf, why are we not doing it? It needs capital investment. It's about a $20 trillion problem we have to spend over the next 10 years, okay? 10, 15 years. So that's a second lever. That will bring the carbon dioxide emissions down. Then you ask, why do you need the third lever? It's simply because there is already 1 trillion tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. It's a blanket surrounding the planet. That's trapping heat every second, every minute, every day, every month, every year for decades and decades. So we have to make that blanket thinner. I have estimated to keep the warming around 1.5, well below 2 degrees, as Glasgow meeting warns, you have to take out about 200 billion tons of carbon dioxide. It's not easy, and we still don't have the technologies, but we need to start investing on that. So, Mr. Bellur, the solutions are there. I'm not claiming it's easy. They are challenging, but the problem we are facing is life-threatening. So we have to go to challenging solutions.
As you mentioned, geopolitics, now Chinese technology in green tech is moving significantly from what we can see here. Do you think geopolitics, Professor, is likely to come in the way of cooperating in climate change? And is there something we can do to keep the geopolitics aside from the science and the need to come together and cooperate on climate change?
Now you're asking me a question which I have no experience in answering. I'm a scientist, not a politician. But
you talk to all the politicians of the world, sir.
On the science. And on the urgency of to do things fast. But I tell you, see, when you talk about climate change and emissions, the focus immediately goes to population. Oh, Africa is going to expand, you know, India is this, and Latin America. But if you look at the emissions, India's emissions to the total pool is about 6%. China, US, and European Union are all factor of 2 to 3 more. I think if these wealthy nations, I'm going to put China in the wealthy nation category, although they're not. China, America, European, the whole European EU, and in Southeast Asia, countries like Singapore, South Korea, and Japan, of course. They take the lead in developing cheaper ways to go to renewable and deploy them. Just by the sheer economy, the rest of the nation, the rest of the world, will have no option but to follow. They can lead, but it's their problem if they don't lead and try to follow. So I think the key, all the nations who are wealthy, who have the infrastructure and people, experts working on this. So that's why I'm not too worried about everyone said, oh, India said coal. I mean, it was, instead of saying, there is a word they were harping on. I forgot what that is. I'm not worried about all that. I'm more focused on not on the issues that divide us, but the issues that unite us. The issue that unites us is, for a sustainable future, we have to electrify everything and generate that electricity with renewables. Period. Just two sentences. That's all it takes.
I want to talk about a little bit about your involvement with the Vatican and Pope Francis, particularly. As we spoke a little while ago, you went to a Jesuit school, and I'm curious to know whether that had a little bit of influence on your decision to take your thoughts to the Pope. And could you give us a description of how you built that relationship with the Vatican leading up to the encyclical that Pope Francis issued on climate?
Yeah, I was not thinking along the lines. You gave me an idea. You said, I come from a Jesuit school. Certainly, I was exposed to Christianity there. We used to say prayers and this. And I didn't connect the two because my invitation to join the Vatican was surely came out of the blue. You know, the Vatican, I think it's the only religion I know which has an Academy of Sciences, and it's called Pontifical Academy of Sciences. The scientists, their dream is to get elected. You see, you cannot join these academies, you have to be elected. So I was elected to the Pontifical Academy of Science in 2004, when I turned 60. And I somehow thought they didn't know I was a Hindu. So when I attend my first meeting, they'll find out I'm a Hindu and throw me out. But it turned out that academy is non-denominational. You are elected just for your scientific achievements. And I was elected personally by Pope John Paul II. Now he, you know, he's a saint. So they hold two meetings. It's mainly on all scientific topics under the earth, including topics like existence of God. And about 2 to 3 years attending meetings in that academy persuaded me this could be an agent of solution, because we had the top scientists, third of the academy members were Nobel laureates. And I was also on the right age. You know, I turned 60 in 2004. And I started getting worried about the climate change problem, both for my own children and then my grandchildren. And I began to see my life's work was sort of a failure, that all I had done was document all the bad things that's happening in the planet. I never thought it was my responsibility to solve the problem. Joining that Pontifical Academy and attending meetings, I started organizing meetings there. It took about 5 years, but I was convinced scientists also have to get into solutions. It's not enough just to keep throwing bad news at people constantly. We need to tell them how to solve it. So in that sense, it had a remarkable impact on me.
Brilliant, Professor. Thanks for that. Do you think we need to somehow enlist religious authorities into this effort? Because the other day I was watching a documentary on the travels of Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith. And I was surprised to see how much sustainability, as we call it these days, was a part of his message. And you see shades of that in Gandhi, you see the Dalai Lama, for instance, His Holiness, who is one of the first religious figures to be applauded for his global environmental effort. Do you think this is one area where religion can be usefully and purposefully deployed, Professor?
Absolutely. I think, you know, that is one of the missing pieces. You know, we earlier talked about how do we convey all this to the people? 3/4 of the world population are religious. And that's one place, whether you are a conservative or you are a liberal, whether you believe in science or you don't, all go to the same church, all go to the same temple, all go to the same synagogue, mosque, everywhere. And one thing which I found looking into all this is this is one area all religions agree, which is nature was created by God. And it's our duty to protect creation. See, that message unites people in terms of taking actions. And I think the UN has recognized this. There is no interfaith gatherings in COP meetings. So I don't know if that's going to be effective in many nations, but certainly I know in the US, for example, it's not going to work in nations like Germany and Netherlands, but in nations like US, almost all the Latin American, South American countries, definitely in South Asia, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, trying to convey this message through local faith leaders, local priests, local bishops, local gurus, is something we need to try. I am certainly pushing hard on that. I want to mention to you a memorable experience I had with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. I met him about four or five times. I was in the, in stage with him for his 80th birthday, which was held at Hollywood here, and also a major event in San Diego. And at the end of one of these meetings, he invited me and the other speaker for, to have a private lunch with him. I'll tell you two things. One is a funny incident, and the second is really profound. So we were all three, they had put the food in a buffet, and we were sitting standing to collect our food, including His Holiness. He told the person who was going to help me, he said, no, I'll do it myself. So he was picking his food, and then he turned to me and he said, Professor Ramanathan, you are shocked, aren't you? I said, no, why do you say that, Your Holiness? You saw me picking up beef. You don't expect a religious person to eat meat. I must say, I was a little bit surprised he took the beef. And then we had lunch. We talked about a number of topics about how he can help. And then it was time for prayers. A lot of the Buddhist monks were there. So they came to take him. So I sort of escorted him to the exit gate. I thought he was just leaving. He turned around, came back, held my right hand with both of his hands. And he said, I want to assure you, I'm going to work on the climate change problem for the rest of my life. And the second thing he said is, I want you to know, if anything in the Buddhist religion, which it says goes against science, I would change what the religion says and accept science. So I see the same spirit in what Pope Francis, and I met many Hindu leaders too in India, all of them same. So that is a unifying force, not for everyone. It may not work in China, or it may not work in Russia, the atheist countries, which is okay. But at least in countries, three-fourths of the population, that's an effective avenue for solving the climate change problem. Prof, thank you for asking this question.
Well, you're welcome, very welcome, sir. Could you talk a bit more about Pope Francis? What a magnificent encyclical he issued. And can you tell us a bit more about your relationship with Pope Francis?
Yeah, you see, this was early 2014. I had organized a meeting on the Alpine glaciers, melting of the Himalayas, melting of the Alps. It was Pope Benedict. He was very interested in that topic. So I briefed Pope Benedict. So I teamed up with a legendary Indian economist, Partha Dasgupta. He was at Cambridge University. So Partha Dasgupta and I said, we have to organize a meeting much broader than climate change. See, we proposed a meeting which is called Sustainable Nature, Sustainable Humanity, Our Responsibility. It was right at the Vatican. So we brought in top thought leaders. At the end of it, I was asked to brief Pope Francis. Pope Francis normally receives us, our academy members, in his receiving palace. It's just the most breathtaking hall I've ever seen. So I was expecting that, but it turned out that day, he got too busy, so he said he will just see us outside. So we were waiting in the parking lot of the Vatican. Pope Francis got out of the car and came straight at me. I had about 80 people, since I was the co-chair of the meeting. It was myself, the chancellor of the academy, who's a bishop, and Dasgupta, and then about 80 people behind us. So Pope Francis came, and then we were told he had only 2 minutes with us. So I had to say everything about that meeting in 2 minutes, and I learned about it just about 10 seconds before he came and shook our hand. So he was introduced, Father Dasgupta introduced our group to him. So he looked at me, so tell me. So I don't know what got into me. I told him what I presented at the meeting. I told Pope Francis that most of the emissions come from the wealthiest 1 billion people on the planet. I told him the poorest 3 billion people whose role in the pollution is 5% or less. But I told him if there is a cliff, they're going to suffer the most. He listened very intently. And then he asked in Spanish, what can he do about it? So I told Pope Francis, I said, Holy Father, you have become a model leader for the world. You have influenced beyond Catholicism. So I hope you will tell people to be good stewards of the planet, protect the planet. And later, within 2-3 months, he started, he released a big statement 2 weeks later, reflecting this. So I knew he was thinking about it. And then he comes up with the encyclical. I had the honor to review that encyclical, give them comments about the science part of it. I want to make sure the science was impeccable in that encyclical. And he had one memorable statement. He says, cry of the earth has to be heard with the cry of the poor. To me, there is no better way to talk about how climate change impacts people.
Wonderful, wonderful story.
So promptly.
Yeah, yes.
Yep,
so promptly.
The Vatican News had an article, the Pope and his Hindu scientist. and they say about, they themselves were surprised.
Right.
See, many Catholic leaders here don't know. The Pontifical Academy has people from all religion, just right. Scientists.
Sure.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I mean, amazing that the Pope gets it that, some might say that poverty is the ultimate pollutant. But has the rest of the world got that message?
Honestly, I don't think so. You see, Mr. Balur, this one of
just
the
call
issues
me Ravi, Professor, yeah.
So one of the reasons we are not solving the problem is that when they hear people like me and others, we say, oh, the poor are going to suffer. It inadvertently has given the impression to those who have the power to solve it, this is the wealthiest 1 billion. This is just going to, people who are poor are going to suffer. I am okay. And I somehow feel we have all become so selfish. We are unable to think beyond us, our children, and our grandchildren. So I'm tapping into that selfish part of us. I tell people, focus on our grandchildren. Forget about the world. You are sending your grandchildren on a plane which has a 10% chance of crashing. That plane is a metaphor for the planet. So, no, I think we are unable to connect when the suffering becomes in millions or billions.
That's a great pity. Prof, I want to end this interview by asking you a question that's on the mind of a lot of people, including in Southeast Asia. What happens if Mr. Donald Trump comes back as President of the United States? He is a person who said, who dismissed climate change, and he called it just the weather. Does it give you sleepless nights to think that we might have a leader like that back in the White House?
Yeah, that brings me to my thinking and theory about how we are going to solve this problem. When the warming hits 1.5 degrees, neither the US president, even if it happens to be Mr. Trump, nor anyone on the planet is going to be able to stop that 1.5 degrees, just in 8 years. When that 1.5 degree, we cross that, like I said, climate change would become, would the major crises the planet faces. It'll move into our living rooms. I am certain that will wake up people and they will be demanding solutions to the climate problem. So even Mr. Trump continues till 2030, he's a person who moves which way the people want him to go. So even he would solve it. So that's my confidence in that nature would demand it and people would listen to nature and not to political leaders.
Oh, that's a brilliant note to end this conversation. Thank you, Professor Ramanathan, for your time. We wish you a very good 2022 and we hope you're work gets read and listened to across the globe, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Ravi. I enjoyed your questions. Thank you very much.
The Asian Insider Podcast channel is also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Like us and rate us.